This is Microphone Check, hip-hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly. Marley Marl is one of the most important people in hip-hop history. He's the one who figured out how to sample, how to get pieces of songs off vinyl records and into a drum machine.
I did a whole snare track all the way through, and then I just started playing with the kick, you know, next. And it just made me realize. I looked at the engineer. He didn't know what the hell I was talking about, what had happened. I was like, do you know what we just did? Do you know what just happened? He's like, yeah, you just took the James Brown snare and you put it on there. But do you know what that means?
Oh, my God.
That means that I could go to my library home. I got so many records. I could take the kicks, the snares from everything and make my own patterns.
Marley came by our studio to talk about why the New York City Housing Authority should get co-producer credit on some of his records, LL Cool J, and the making of one of the first posse cuts, the Juice Crew's The Symphony. I don't know what y'all gonna do with this, but it got to be funky. It got to be funky if you're gonna be on it. I don't care who start, I don't care what y'all do, but you got to be finished before the music is through. You're listening to Microphone Check, hip-hop from NPR Music. I'm Franny Kelly.
I'm Ali Shaheed Muhammad.
And I'm DJ Marley Marl.
Woo!
M-A-R-L-E-Y-M-A-R-L. The DJ.
And we're talking on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of In Control Volume 1.
Wow, it's been that long? I felt like I just finished. You know, a lot of history is packed into that one, so we got a lot to talk about. 25 years.
25.
Wow.
How old were you then?
I was in my upper 20s around then. It's when I first bought my first house with that budget right there.
Did you know it was going to be a hit?
I had an inkling that it would do well because, you know, the momentum that the Juice Crew was building at that time, and, you know, I just felt that, you know, it was going to be a retrospect of the Juice Crew, where we was at that time. That's what it was all about.
And where was the Juice Crew at that time?
Well, the Juice Crew was a budding new crew that was coming into the rap scene by ways of Mr. Magic. You know, we had Big Daddy Kane, it's Kool G Rap, it's Roxanne Shanté, there's MC Shan, Craig G, Master Ace, and Biz Markie. Collectively, we were called the Juice Crew because everybody had enough talent on their own to break out and do their own individual solo thing. So,
and what about the photo shoot for In Control Volume 1?
Wow, the In Control Volume 1 photo shoot. That was incredible. You know, my ex-wife at the time, she had a great idea. I got to give her the credit. You know, I'm going to take her credit away. She said, you know, you guys are on a rise. You need to take a photo in front of a Learjet to make it seem like you're bigger than life, because at that point I haven't seen any rappers in front of Learjets. And she had the vision. Actually, she was the main stylist or editor for Elle magazine at that time, and that propelled us into, you don't even know, we became stars after that photo shoot.
Yeah, applaud to your ex-wife, man. That's some vision, because it looked like, it felt like you guys are larger than life. And I know I wanted to be like Marley Marl, like no question.
Just, can I tell you something? The day that we took that picture in front of the Learjet, I was still living in the projects. Mm. I was paying like $110 a month for my rent, you know, free electricity. So, you know, New York City Housing Authority kind of co-produced some of my earlier hits. Thank you, guys.
Taxpayers. All right.
Thanks, guys. It was the crack era. Come on.
And is it true that you went straight from the photo shoot to the studio to make the symphony?
Yes, we did. We all went. We was like, yo, let's go make a record. You know, let's go. That song.
Career launching.
Yeah, that was a career launching record and a career saving record for some. It could have been.
How did you discover sampling?
Well, you know, I was into electronica first. I was like a DJ's DJ. I wasn't like just a rap DJ. So I was interning at Unique Studios, seeing a lot of technology happen, you know, really playing around with Fairlight computers when, you know, they was too expensive to touch. So what happened one day, I was in the studio and I was, you know, working on a Captain Rock record. And what happened, I was actually trying to get a riff off of a record, and I made a mistake and got the snare in there before the sound came. I was truncating the vocal part, but the snare was playing with the beat. You know, we was truncating while the beat was playing. Thank God the beat was playing, because it probably wouldn't have happened if the beat wasn't playing. So I was playing, and the snare sounded better than the snare that I had from the drum machine when I was popping it. I was like, yo, hold on. I started rocking it. And then it just smacked me in the face, what just happened. I was like, hold up. This will enable me to take any kick in the snare from any record that people love and make my own beat. And I did a whole snare track all the way through. And then I just started playing with the kick, you know, next. And it just made me realize. I looked at the engineer. He didn't know what the hell I was talking about, what had happened. I was like, do you know what we just did? Do you know what just happened? He's like, yeah, you just took the James Brown snare and you put it on there. But do you know what that means?
Oh, my God.
He's like, yeah, it means you took the James Brown snare. I was like, yo, it means more than that. That means that I could go to my library home. I got so many records. I could take the kicks, the snares from everything and make my own patterns. He looked at me like I was crazy. Like, what the hell are you talking about?
That's amazing, man. Like, yeah, I'm being very calm here, but like, yo, you're my hip hop idol. And wow. Just to hear that story, it's like the blueprint of hip hop is based off of that story right there.
Yeah, kind of.
You know, my generation of hip hop.
Re-hip-hop. Because, you know, there was people making records before that. You know, there was a lot of people. I mean, the pioneers, I take off my hat to them, because those guys really paved the way for something big that was coming that they didn't even know what was coming. I mean, they made a lot of records. They wasn't the greatest records for rap. Because, to be honest, when I was into electronica and I heard the first rap records come out, I was one to believe that rap wasn't going to be around. Like, I was like, it's not going to be old ass.
When you say, like, the first records, what are you referencing? Like Mantronics? Like before
no,
that?
No, it's even before Mantronics. I'm talking about, you know, because I'm talking about, like, the earlier pioneers, like the you know, the Crash Crew songs, like the earlier Sugar Hill songs, and, you know, a lot of the earlier, you know, like the Fat Boys and a lot of the earlier Curtis Blow productions were great songs and great hooks, but it wasn't really touching what made me love rap. And I'm sure it wasn't touching what made people fall in love with rap. You know, when you got the rap tapes from Harlem back in the day and in the Bronx, you would hear scratching, echoes, beatboxing, and, you know, just the echoes and just the element of breakbeats. Mm-hmm. So by the time I brought sampling in, and, you know, Mr. Magic heard one of my remixes that I made and asked to play it on the radio. Now I become his DJ.
Which remix was that?
It was a Buffalo Gals remix.
Oh, okay.
You know, sometimes I still play it, and that's the remix that changed my life.
Got that little snare popping off when you're feeling good about just discovering, like, I don't know, you stumbled on that, and right. Then who was the first person you felt like you wanted to bring that energy?
The Molly Scratch. Yeah, that was like the first big boom bapping samples, drums that changed my production skills, that changed me as a producer. That song did it.
All of his beats and my rhymes attached. Call them all they scratch. We're always steered at a positive course. His beats, my rhymes, combine, made force.
That song, for me, I lost my mind when I heard that as a kid.
Wow.
So I just was like, I didn't know what it was, but I knew it was like...
It was hip-hop.
Yeah, it was the greatest thing
It was
ever.
Probably what you loved about hip-hop, everything you loved. There was echoes on there.
Yeah, echoes, the beat was, thick.
Yeah.
The beat was so thick.
Yeah.
Shan's just his style on there, like, you know, even spelling your name. It was just all these elements that just...
Right.
It just felt like the best thing created ever. Yeah. And so you take that, and it's interesting because... That same sample, you kind of carried in a few records.
Okay. Yep, of course.
So it's like as potent as a sperm cell. Can I say that on NPR right now?
Go crazy.
I mean, from Adam to wherever we end up, like, that's what Marley Marl's drum sound to me. It's like you repeat things, but it's always fresh and authentic.
Oh, yeah. You know, I guess it was just a thing in time. I mean, you don't know you're making history. You're just going with your heart, and As long as I can make the people dance outside my window, that's all I was cared about.
So part of what you're talking about is translating the live performative aspect of hip-hop to a recording.
Right. And the feeling that those tapes from Harlem back in the days, you know, how they used to make you feel and how they felt. You know, it was you know, you hear the crowd roaring, you hear the echoes, you hear mistakes, you hear the great parts, you hear, you know, everything. You might hear gunshots in the background, but that's what made a lot of people love hip-hop. You got to think, it wasn't on the radio, and it was tapes that people would record right from their box, straight off the microphone. And those tapes would resonate throughout the city, and that's how most of the people who loved hip-hop in the early 80s, late 70s, and stuff like that, this how, you know, this was our smoke signals. Those tapes, those early tapes coming out of Harlem and the Bronx.
What were some of your early musical influences? Because if you listen to some of the things like the James Browns, Otis Redding, like maybe the Five Stair Steps and stuff like that, it may seem like we have a real insight to your musical taste, but you also mentioned that you're an electronic producer, so you know, so I don't know if that means Kraftwerk. I mean, so
you know who my hero was before I even got into hip hop, and I just gotta lay it on the line, Giorgio Moroder. I was into Giorgio like you would not believe. See, I was into electronic music. I was into, you know, triggering bass lines and making it sequence and make me... Seriously, I was a sequence head, dude. That's how I beat people in hip-hop early, because I was already sequencing. I knew what a trigger was. I knew how to trigger anything off of anything. You know, the whole bridge, my song I made with MC Shan, all that was trigger music. Triggering samples from an 808 with separate samplers around the room. You know, the pulse from the 808 would go into my sampler and make it react. Once I made that discovery at Unique, guess what I did? I went right around the corner to Sam Ash, bought myself three little cheap samplers. I went home and started, you know, experimenting, taking all my drum sounds. Matter of fact, what I would do at that point, I went to my reel-to-reel. I would go to records. I would have leader, snare, leader, leader, kick, leader, hi-hat, leader on a reel. And I would sit with the artist and say, so, we want to make songs today. You know, pick out your kick and snare you want. Boom. Yeah, give me that one. Now, this is before disc. That was my disc. I still have that reel. And that is the same drum reel I lost it in Power Play Studios, and they made the bridges over.
I was just going to ask you about that. I was going to ask you. So is that story true? I didn't know if that was true.
Of course. That's a true story.
Tell the whole thing.
Well, one day I was in Power Play Recording Studios in Long Island City, and it's so funny that... I'd say Long Island City, which was like a Queensbridge studio up the street from Queensbridge. And do you know the Bridges Over was made in Queensbridge? That's crazy. But anyway, and off my drum sounds. Because I was, you know, that was the day that Mr. Magic met BDP. And, you know, for years I was always wondering, why these guys are so mad at us? You know, we killing the game right now. Come on, what are you talking about? I never understood. Who are they? So one day I was looking at KRS-One's bio, and he said, one day it all started when Mr. Magic dissed us at Power Play. I was like, I don't remember that, because I was with Magic all the time. Then I started remembering. I remember a crew that he dissed because they was nice and waited and said, oh, Mr. Magic, could you listen to our stuff? It's died. It's up. Come in the room. And, you know, Magic was arrogant, so he's like, I'll give you a shot. Let me go and listen to your shit. So we go in there, and they bumping it, everybody's jumping around like it's the shit. Magic like goes over to the knob and just turns it down while everybody's dancing. Everybody stop. Oh, you like it? He's like, yo, this is garbage.
Wow.
Straight garbage. He looked at me, he said, yo, you want real shit? Marley Marl, MC Shan, Roxanne Shante, Mr. Magic, y'all suck. And he just straight walked out the room.
Oh, no.
And I remember that was the day that I was trying to get up out of the studio because he made somebody real mad. And and getting out of the studio so quick, I lost my drum reel. And then I decided, I can't find it. I thought I misplaced it in my crib or something. I didn't realize I lost it at Power Play. and The Bridges Over came out, it still didn't hit me. Hearing the record, it still didn't hit me that that was my drums. I was like, you know, later on, then an engineer told me, he said, you know, I found my drum reel about 6 months later at Power Play on the manager's desk. Yo, Gary, what the fuck is this doing here? He said, oh, you left this here. I was going to give it to you. I'm like, it's like, oh, 6 months later. And then when the engineers told me, he said, hey, you know, Sed G found your drum reel. Mm. I was like, yeah. He said, yeah, when he made Bridges Over, he put your drum reel up. I was there. I seen him do it. I was like, for real? Then I went back and listened to the record. I was like, that's my kick and snare. Pitched up one on the SB-1200.
Yo, one mighty sperm cell. That's all I have to say. There's so many different lessons in that.
Yeah. Lesson number one, don't lose your drum reel.
That's it. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. Hey, the bridge is over. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. You see me coming in the dance with the slipper sensei. Down with the sound called BDP. If you want to join the crew, well, you must see me. You can't sound like Shannon or the one Marley. Because Shannon, Marley, Marlon, my rhyming like the gay.
How did you meet Mr. Magic?
I was, you know, Dr. Bob Lee really saved my life. You know, I was in Queensbridge, you know, not doing so well with myself, like following the wrong people, you know, and he came and literally saved my life. He came, took his van on the block, got in front of the place that I was at where I didn't belong with the microphone, said, hey, Marley, come on out. Come on, let's go. We got things to do. That embarrassing me kind of, so I came out and started hanging with him. And, you know, since I had talent as, you know, as the local talented DJ, and, you know, stuff was starting to pop for me because, you know, I was interning at Unique, so I was already into what I was doing. And, you know, my producing was just, I was into electronic. I wasn't even into the rap stuff. So, you know, I was doing remixes for me when I DJed every once in a while, you know. And he heard one of my remixes, and he's like, yo, can I put that on the radio? Can I please put that on the radio? That's my why my record don't do that? I was like, because it's a Marley Marl remix, and your record is not, you know. And then, can I play it? I was like, no.
What?
At first, I was like, no, because, you know, we didn't really get along at first, so, you know, because he's too arrogant. He was, you know, I didn't know him, so he was arrogant to me.
He's, like, he's trying to put your music on the radio, and you're like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I didn't even like him at that point. But, you know, after a while, that day, you know, I was playing more remixes and more stuff. He's like, yo, come on, man, you got to let me put some of this on the radio, man. This is dope. My records don't do this. You listen, I got a million listeners. All right, where's it at? I'll come. I'll come and play it for you. Okay, I was like, I had attitude like that because he was so arrogant. And, you know, to me, before I even met him, I didn't like him because he was arrogant to me.
How old were you?
I was about 16. 16-ish. When I got on the radio, I got on the radio when I was 17.
Wow. So you met Magic, and what was the relationship like from the jump?
Well, at first I didn't like him, and then I got to know him, and you know, he would come pick me up because I was that broke and poor. I didn't have money to even get to Manhattan, and that was. That was just like over the bridge. So he would come pick me up and bring me to the radio station. And the first night, you know, when he first played one of my remixes, he knew that I was different because he would play the mix and he was going to grab a record to go behind it. I was like, what you doing? That don't mix with it. I like kind of sucked my teeth. What you doing, man? That don't mix with it. He's like, what you mean don't mix with it? Show me. Go through here and find out. Show me what you mean. So I was going through the bins. So the record was, you know, it was about a minute left. So I picked up a record, went over to the turntable. Pitched it, got the timing right, and it was he didn't trust me, so he brought the fader up over the air and brought the other one down. It was like a smooth transition. And, you know, in that time, there was not smooth transitions in hip-hop because everybody was scratching and going back and forth. That's what it all was about.
Right.
But I bought a blend factor because I came from electronica. When I was a club DJ, we would do nice blends. Mm-hmm. Nobody was blending in hip-hop.
Yeah, it drives me crazy.
Yeah. You know, if a DJ can't go over four bars in the mix, you suck.
You heard that?
If you can't blend for more than four bars and it starts going off beat after four bars and you got to slide the fader across and save face, you suck.
Go back home and practice.
Yeah, you suck. You really suck.
Just go back home and practice. So at 16, you're interning. You're yes. turning down offers to get on the radio. Yeah.
I really didn't I didn't even know what it meant. I didn't know what it was going to turn into.
You kind of like in the neighborhood doing things.
Right.
Queensbridge produced a lot of talent.
Let me tell you, man. There's something in that water, man.
I want to know what's in the water.
You got to go get a specimen. Something in the water at Queensbridge. That's all I got to say because you got to think of the six blocks have made a lot of stars. NBA stars. Singers, rappers, and it was going on before we even started, you know. It's a thin line between love and hate. Those guys wrote that out there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Those guys, it was a studio right in Queensbridge that, you know, they made that song out there. Man, Adana, Bofana, Bofana. Back in the day, that lady that made Shirley so-and-so, she was a resident of Queensbridge back in the day. The Name Game song.
Wow.
So, you know. It's been, you know, and before we even started with hip-hop, you know, there's like Daryl Payne who made like the Thanks to You, all the Cinnamon records, and a lot of the disco era stuff.
What did you learn from growing up in Queensbridge that you still carry with you today that's like prominent part of your life?
Well, life lessons, you know, number one, you know, always ride smooth and, you know, ride quiet but carry a big stick. You know, that's like the number one cardinal rule that I've learned from living in the hood in Queensbridge. You know, be nice to people because you never know. Everything's full circle. Everything comes back around. That's most important. And, you know, and the family aspect, you know, there's nothing like the QB family. I mean, QB's a family.
Hmm.
You know, they're always happy for everyone's success. And, you know, and it just goes on. It's like you're carrying the torch. You're keeping the legacy going. So, you know, I learned a great family, you know, ethic from living in Queensbridge, man.
How'd you tie in to the Brooklyn Cats?
Hmm.
Big Daddy Kane. Was Biz from Brooklyn?
Biz was from
everywhere, right?
Biz was the original, wherever I lay my hat is my home. He was the original Rolling Stone. But I got with the Brooklyn crew. Basically, you know, Kane was brought to me through Biz Markie. I met Biz Markie. Biz Markie hung out for the weekend in Queensbridge one day, and everybody was telling me what a great, phenomenal beatbox guy he was. And, you know, the Fat Boys was ruling at that time. I'm like, dude, do I need another beatbox? Come on, dude. I don't want to even hear that. Hmm. No, but he's special. He's special. He's good. And I heard him go, I was like, he's special. He's good. Come to my house tomorrow. Let's get busy. I got something for you. I got a beat for you. I got something for you. So then Biz, his ghostwriter was Kane. Hmm. And then one day Kane showed up at my door saying, I was supposed to meet Biz at the train station over here. You know, I got some lyrics for him. I'm his writer. I'm like, come on. He got to do better than that to get in my house, dude. You can't tell me he's just his writer and you're going to get in. Tell me something you wrote for him that didn't come out yet. And he said, a line that I knew never came. Oh, this must be true because he knew. Mm. So I let him in, and then, you know, Biz came, and that's my boy Kane. You know, then after a while, Kane started coming to sessions, never saying that he was a rapper. And then one day he came by himself and said, you know, I want to hear myself on voice. You want to hear my voice on the track? I said, okay, let's see what you got. And I just threw up, I'll Take You There. And that was our first song we ever made together.
Hear ye from far and near. The one they call the Big Daddy Kane is here to deliver a message to everyone everywhere. So listen up, party people, cause this you should hear. It's a story of a faraway atmosphere that you will find very rare and far beyond compare. All is sincere and rather debonair. So let's all gather round because
so a guy like Pete Rock comes along.
Yeah.
How does he make you feel?
Wow, that's dope because now I have a session with Heavy D up at the House of Hits, and he brings his cousin over, his young cousin who's just getting his ears wet in this hip hop thing. So what happened? I was doing a song called Girls They Love Me, and you know I was a little tired. I didn't want to do the cuts, And so P Rock goes over to the turntable and just playing around. He's just playing around with the turntable, cutting and the headphones, and I hear what he's doing. I was like, "Yo, this guy got crispy cuts." I was like, "Yo, you want to cut on this song?" He's like, "Yo, I could do it." He's like, "Yeah." He's like, "Pete never made a record yet at this point." He's like a hard bottom shoe wearing guy coming to my house. You know, he's like in hard bottoms. He's chilling though, you know what I'm saying? But he wasn't, you know, he didn't make a record yet. He was like Heavy's younger cousin, and he did the cuts on the records. They was dope.
Cooling in my crib and I'm cold maxing. Pull up with Judy, I'm in the mood for relaxing. Get my phone book from top of the shelf. I dial 66. I better keep it to myself. Call up with Judy with the triple star next.
See, we paid him for what he did. He was like, "Wow, I'm getting my first money in you know, in this game." Then I had, you know, DJ Kevy Kev was one of my DJs, and Clark Kent was a DJ. Now, I would switch up with them. Now, my DJ, Kevy Kev, crashes his car, breaks his leg, can't come to the radio station. I get on the phone. "Yo, Heavy, what's up with your cousin that was at the studio, like, last month? Tell him to meet me at WBLS. I may want him to DJ. I need a DJ." You know, okay. He's like, "Okay, now. This is how God works in such mysterious ways." Pete Rock really didn't have all the songs to play on the radio, but he had a lot of break beats. So what he would do, I would play some songs, he would go through the breakbeats. And he would do it in such a way that it made it so funky that, you know, all right, we was doing a rap show, but we had a little edge over it because we was playing breaks too.
You weren't just playing songs people could buy.
Right. We was playing some of the breaks that made the songs, and he's cutting it up, and he was a phenomenal scratcher. And you could tell he would cut a record for like 5 minutes. Straight back to back, straight back and forth perfectly. So that got a lot of people's attention. And Pete Rock, he broke himself off on the radio. He got known in like 1 month.
Yeah.
One quick month, he was already on his way. Now we have Pete Rock here.
LL Cool J.
Don't call it a comeback.
Let's go back to jingling.
Wow. And that was one of the pinnacle points of LL's return.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a big way. Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, man. Like, you've had such a history. I don't ever know if there was ever a down moment, but it seemed like that moment was like enlightening for you, because then, again, it just highlighted the remix and the special aspect of your remixes. But then, I mean, comes the next album, the monster album.
Wow.
For LL.
That opened the door. You know, we did the remix. It did well. You know, his numbers started going back up. The street cred was right. And no more getting booed on 125th Street. No more getting booed in Harlem.
Can we describe what happened exactly?
I think it was an anti-gun rally. Matter of fact, I did see it was an anti-gun rally in Harlem. And, you know, I think P.E. was performing. And they said, "Yeah, I want to shout out my boy LL Cool J. He's here." Boo! And I seen a video of his face. I was like, wow. I heard about it, but I'd never seen it until I saw the video. And, you know, his street cred wasn't right because, because of the Walking with a Panther album, which it was a great album, but it wasn't street because N.W.A. started coming out at that point. You got Public Enemy fighting the power, and, you know, it was political, a gunshot. He was in the middle, and that's just what happened. I guess the hood felt that he wasn't supplying them with what they want, and they kind of booed him, and he had to regroup, you know, and His grandmother said, "Go knock him out," and he came to my house, and we knocked him out.
Come on, man. And with the local DBC news, LL Cool J with a triumphant comeback. For a solo, but tonight, don't call it a comeback. I've been here for years. I'm rocking my pants, foot suckers and beer, making the tears rain down like a monsoon. Listen to the bass go boom, explosion. Wreck his shop. When I drop these lyrics that'll make you call the cops. Don't you dare stare. You better move.
guys came back so strong. What was the conversation in going into that album?
The conversation, it was none. You know what it was? It was strictly hitting the clubs, driving home about 120 miles an hour, almost killing yourself to get to the studio with that same vibe that you felt in the club, and go make records and go get this thing back.
Do you get that energy today?
Sure.
Still?
Yes, I do. I'm still a fan. You know, that's why I could make a dope remix now. That's why I could feel that, you know, I could do what I do, because I'm still a fan of what I do. You know, that's how it works. You know, once I become not a fan of what I do, that's when the problems come. You know, you stay a fan of what it is. I stay a fan to the whole genre. You know, maybe it's personal, but, you know, like, I'm still a personal fan to this. You know, I don't look at rap music today as it sucks like a lot of people would think. I look at progression, because things have to progress. I'm sure I made a lot of people mad when I came with sampling and put it in hip-hop.
Right.
So I'm sure, you know, somebody's like, oh, that's not nothing. Da-da-da. All they're doing is taking somebody's music. But, you know, there's a craft to sampling. The art of sampling is the premieres. You know, you got to look at the Pete Rocks. Even Kanye took it to, like, the next stratosphere. You know, you got to look at the Jay Dillas. You know, you got to look at the work that, even the work that Q-Tip put in, you know, as being the ghost dude in the game. You got to look at all of that. That's creative work, creative sampling right there.
I was going to ask you about a couple, but you named them. Yeah. The only one that you left out, I was thinking, was Flying Lotus, and only because he's from the electronica hip-hop aspect of it.
There you go.
You know.
That's right.
Can we talk about Symphony?
Sure. I don't care who first and who last.
I have a lot of questions. So, I mean, that's a pretty recognizable sample, though.
Oh, yeah. That's why I was kind of chopped up, because, you know, the
your attention's undivided. Many in the past have tried to do what I did. Just the way I came off then, I'm gonna come off stronger and longer, even with the drum off. I'll keep on going and flowing just like a river. I got a whole lot to give, so I'm a giver. Little at a time, new trails are blazing. Action is in effect and always stays in. Yeah, just like a shot from a cannon. I am the man in charge and I'm the planning.
That was one of the loops that I got from the WBLS library. You know, I was privileged enough to have access to, like, one of the greatest libraries in music history. I had, you know, Hal Jackson's records. You know, he used to keep all his records at the WBLS library, and that was one of them. The kick, the drums under it was one of them.
Did you bring the records home and then bring them back? Like, oh, do you not want to say? You just brought the SP-12 up to BLS and you sampled it, right?
No, what I did, I would
check them out.
I would really take the records home and sample them, and I would bring them back for sure. Because, you know, most of them I brought back. Most of them, I could say. 100% of them didn't go back, but most of them went back.
Thank you, WBLS.
Thank you, Hal Jackson. Rest in peace. Thank you, brother.
I always thought, like, Cold Chillin' was your label.
I know. Everybody thought that. It wasn't. I was actually a staff producer, so I knew that would open doors for me further down, because the funny thing about my whole Cold Chillin' experience back in the day, as opposed to my whole Def Jam LL experience, is that one album outsold my whole career down there. You know? So I knew it was about numbers, and I knew it was about progression, and I knew it was about moving forward and moving this hip-hop thing forward, because, yeah, I was with, you know, we had fun at Cold Chillin'. We had a lot of fun, and we made a lot of good local records that did really well. But my successes in life came after that. Really.
Lords of the Underground.
Really. Grammys, you know.
What were you feeling when you met those guys? Like, what was, like, I'm pretty sure at that time you were still are, like, God to them, you know. But the energy felt, at least for me, hearing that album, because I was like, yo, this is like, it put pressure on me.
Wow.
And...
like, In which way?
Because, you have to understand, Marley, you're like the everything in terms of our crew. You know, Q-Tip and Pfeiffer from Queens, everything that you did from the radio perspective.
Gotcha.
So, you know, in aspiring to take what you did and build on it and to try to, you know, be worthy in a sense in what we're doing, what we're creating. How do I say this?
Y'all were in competition.
In a respectful way.
It's like, in 1993, right? You have Here Come the Lords and Midnight Marauders.
Yeah.
Like, how do you...
That's what I'm saying. It was like pressure because it had that Marley Marl. Like, it's like the thing that we aspire towards. And then it's like your dad or, you know, your big bro just like coming and just putting that whooping on you. It's just like... Dang, it's like, I can't live, can I? It's
but
like,
let me tell you, though. I never, you know, to be honest, I never looked at... like Tribe as competition, to be honest, because Tribe always was my favorite group that I never produced. You know what I'm saying? Always. I tell everybody that. I don't care. Straight up, I tell everybody any interview, my favorite all-time group in rap is Tribe Called Quest. Mm-hmm. That's hands down.
It's
so
crazy, man.
I always looked at you guys like, wow. You know, y'all took rap to, you know, we was kind of like the gritty, grimy, project-y dudes who's just making it and people just like us for what we do. I felt that by the time y'all came out, you know, y'all kind of made it cool. You know what I'm saying? Y'all had cool rap. We had dingy raps. This is how I looked at it. We's like from the hood, from the projects. You know, I'm making songs in my house. You know what I'm saying? You guys got on like African beads and chilling. You know what I'm saying? it was cool. You guys made rap actually cool. So that's why I never looked at like. It was like crazy competition, like we gotta beat them. I felt like it was like a different plane. I kind of felt that. That's why I even went with L, kind of, because for me, it was kind of me like cleaning up my act, going with LL, because, you know, LL was Mr. Ladies Love. Girls, you know, girls love him, and, you know, he's that guy, you know, he's ready to make movies, you know what I'm saying? So I looked at my career like, all right, I'm trying to move over here to the cool side. I'm trying to do some cool stuff now. Because, right. you know, we was kind of like pioneerish. We wasn't pioneers, but we was pioneers in our own right.
Yeah, you definitely were pioneers. I mean, still to this day, you go, I don't know, any corner of the world, Cologne or wherever, Melbourne, it's just like you play any one of your songs and people go bananas.
And that's the God's will, because you don't know that when you're making these songs that it could even last that long. I mean, it's God's will because... Dude, I made my first record in 81, and we're here talking about hip-hop right now at NPR. God's will.
No doubt. Lords of the Underground.
Wow.
Do you think there was anything special about the year 1988?
Oh, yeah.
Why do you think it was so productive and creative?
Because 88, you got to look at the atmosphere, the climate. It was like do or die because crack was rampant. Nighttime was night of the living dead. So you really had to, you know, if you wasn't going to do it, if you wasn't going to be over here, you was going to be over there. And, you know, it made a difference for me because, all right, I'm from Queensbridge. It was a rough ride until one year I went to London and seen how famous I was. I came home a clean person, and I've been clean ever since that day.
Wow.
Because no rehab, no nothing. I just saw how famous I was in another country. People knew my name. They were screaming my name. That changed my life. That showed me that there's more to my six blocks where I was living. Because, you know, you got to look at the 80s was do or die. 88 was do or die. 89 was a little more do or die than 88. But if you got into the 90s, clearly, you was okay. Records were selling at that point. So we were taking more serious. The budgets were bigger. The videos looked better. You know, the gold chains were bigger. No, real though, you know. Because, you know, we were proven at that point.
What was the craziest thing you've ever purchased that you're like, man, that was probably not the smartest thing?
I tell you the crazy thing I never purchased that would have not been the smartest thing. I was, I live up in Rockland, so down the street is Upper Saddle River. So you got the million-dollar houses down there. Russell Simmons and Kimora used to live around the corner. You know, Wyclef had something over there, and, everybody, Run's house is filmed up there. So it's like the next town over. So I always had my eye on this big old conglomerate house about 4-point-something. It would have been nice, but when I was deciding to buy the house, I also had my eye on an SSL board for my house. So I was like debating, should I get this big house or should I put this SSL board that costs 3 times as much as my house right now in my house? So what should I do? So I was about to sign off on the house, but something told me, get that board. And I built the studio in my house, and I was able to accommodate the Mama Said album. I was able to make a Grammy off of that console. I was able to, make the console pay for itself. Mm. So I think the biggest thing that I never bought that would have been stupid to me was that house. Mm. Yeah, I never, Dukes. I never even had, to be honest, I never bought a Dookie rope. So I wasn't into, buying things that, I never did nothing stupid like that, never. Yes. Yeah, I never really did.
Yeah, the cover of In Control, those aren't your chains.
Nah.
Those are canes?
Yes, they are. Cane and G-Raps. I borrowed those for the shot. As you see on the back, I don't have any chains on. They have them on. So I borrowed it for the shot, and I never bought a Dookie rope. How you like that? I never bought one.
I believe it.
Yeah, I never did. I
always admired the way you roll, just the way you carry yourself. Like, you've been the blueprint for me, my movement in this music business.
Well, thank you so much
for having me. I mean, just when y'all said the 25th anniversary of In Control, that's incredible because time really does fly. And, like I said, the album was a perspective of the Juice Crew and where we were all at talent-wise. And, it was just a perspective. And, it was my time because since I was producing everybody, it was my time to have an album. Since I wasn't really a rapper, I would do an album where I showcase my talents. And that would be my little MCs at that time.
That's funny, man. This is Microphone Check, Hip Hop from NPR Music.
Microphone Check, baby!
Now we're going to jack that.
Word.
Keep it forever.
Use it.
All right.
Microphone Check, baby!
Yeah, we good?
Yeah, we're good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.